From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, how the climate for political research and analysis has changed in the last 30 years. Later, who is the right Wisconsin artist to take up residence in Luxembourg?
We really want somebody who has a kind of pioneering mindset. And this is the first year of the program, so a lot of how the program works, I think, will be determined by this first individual.
And Great Lakes surfing has boomed in recent years, but some things surfers say have not changed.
We still have this great feeling, this vibe among us that, you know, we do something kind of crazy and kind of unique, and it's nothing like the ocean.
Lake Effect comes your way next after the news. It's Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for being with us today. We've had Public Policy Forum President Rob Henkin on this show on many occasions, talking about the forum's latest policy analysis papers, from looking at local government finances to sketching out hypothetical models for funding cultural institutions. But when we caught up with Rob Henkin recently for the latest in a series of conversations recorded at the University Club of Milwaukee, it was to talk more generally about the climate for political research. Henkin has been around government for almost three decades, from work for a Democratic Massachusetts congressman to serving in an administrative role in Milwaukee County government under then-county executive Scott Walker. All this after starting his career as a radio journalist. Rob Henkin, welcome back to Lake Effect.
Thank you for having me, Mitch.
Is it exhausting being nonpartisan?
It can be exhausting. In fact, one of our former staffers once said to me, "What's it like to be in your head?" Because every time you say anything, you then think about what the opposing viewpoint would say. It can be exhausting, but I think it can also be exhilarating because, my start was answering congressional mail for a member of Congress. And the starting point for formulating a position on an issue was always to research both sides of the issue, present both sides to the member of Congress, and then have him come up with his position. And I think that that still is something that I try to do to this day, and I wish more people did that who worked in government and politics.
Well, right. That was the starting point for your congressman, and perhaps more often than not, members of Congress and representatives at many levels. But that is not necessarily the case today, would you find?
I find that today folks are just so eager to form their position first and then do the research to support the position. And inevitably, what we see on both sides of the political spectrum is people increasingly only reading materials that they know are going to support their point of view or that share their same ideological opinion, or talking to others who are like-minded. We don't see the type of dialogue that goes across ideological poles anymore.
Well, so then we've talked about many of the specific research projects the forum has undertaken in the past, but what in an ideal world is the impact of the work you do in this current political climate?
The elevator speech I can give you, Mitch, is that we want to try to make sure that the key policy decisions being made in our region are based on data and on thoughtful research. And it doesn't mean that everybody's always going to agree. It doesn't mean that politics and ideology are not going to enter into the decision-making process. But with most issues, there should be at least sort of a certain grounding set of facts that should be the beginning point for the policy deliberation. And so if the Public Policy Forum can help provide those facts, then we believe that ultimately we're at least setting the stage for a better decision-making process.
I wonder, and maybe this is one of those questions about what is it like to be in your head, but you know, often we see where we see the Public Policy Forum quoted, it's in a PolitiFact column in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, or it's in a pull quote in a political ad that might be using research that you have done to cast a negative light on the opposition. Is that part of the spirit of what the Public Policy Forum is all about? When you think back over the 100 years plus now that it has been around, is this just par for the course?
It is, and it comes with the territory, and we always say that what we will do is put our research out there, and people are free to use it as they see fit. Now, can that get disconcerting at times? Of course it can. I always say that by far the most difficult challenge I've ever had professionally, and certainly in my 6 years at the Forum, was the year that we were doing our annual analysis of the city and county budgets. Those budgets were put out by candidate Scott Walker and candidate Tom Barrett. So we knew that anything we said in our budget analysis, these are 20-page reports, there was going to be a sentence, several sentences in each of those reports that somebody could have pulled out and used in an ad, either an ad supporting where, hey, the Forum says that Mayor Barrett is a fiscally responsible mayor, or conversely, to the extent that we were critiquing some provision in the budget, that it could be in an attack ad saying, see, the Public Policy Forum says that this candidate is irresponsible. So it's difficult, but I do think that we see it as part of the territory of doing what we do.
You mentioned that your career started in doing legislative correspondence. Before that, you were a journalist and studied journalism. And I wonder, how do you think your journalism background informs your approach to policy analysis?
My journalism background has been instrumental. In fact, I was just doing an informational interview with somebody just yesterday who has a journalism background, who was asking me whether he thought he had a chance of getting into the public policy realm. And really, I think, number one, some of these issues are so nuanced and are so complicated. So the ability to boil down a complicated issue and to present it in a concise way is a skill that you learn, particularly when you're becoming a radio journalist, which I was. I would go and cover a three-hour school board meeting, and I would get 30 seconds of airtime to tell my listeners what happened of consequence at that school board meeting.
It's a glamorous job.
It is. And so I think that skill has served me well at the Public Policy Forum. It also served me well as a congressional staffer and as a county staffer for many, many years because elected officials don't have time to read 20-page memoranda on every single issue that's coming before them. So the ability of staff to, again, boil down complicated issues is a very important one and one that journalistic training really can help support.
Well, and I would imagine as someone who puts a lot of these reports together, you must be aware that so many of the people that read it are going to read the executive summary and maybe scan some of the charts that they find later on.
Yep, and so that's sort of the converse of it because while, again, I just said that being able to boil down complicated issues and succinctly describe them is critical, there's a danger in that too. Many of these issues are extremely nuanced. Many of these issues, the way the Public Policy Forum operates, we do like to carefully lay out both sides of an issue. So there is a danger that if you only read the 2-page executive summary, you're really not getting the full picture. But the problem is a 40 or 50-page report, admittedly, is something that most citizens don't have time to read.
There's a little bit of also the idea of speaking truth to power that goes into what you do and also what journalists do?
Yes, I think that clearly in terms of what is truth, we try to drill down facts. I think the best example I can come up with is our recent research on the arts and cultural institutions. And the Public Policy Forum is decidedly not taking a side in terms of whether there should be some new or enhanced public funding source to support our cultural institutions or a new arena for that matter. But what we could do was in a very factual way lay out the business models for these key institutions, describe their financial condition, describe their physical condition, and try to quantify that. And so our conclusion is, yes, there's a problem here. There's a lot of deferred maintenance. These business models are not working for several of these institutions in large measure because the facilities can no longer support the business model. So the choice is either some of these may have to go away, or conversely, if we want them all to remain, then we don't see any other options but to have some enhanced public funding. And so we can say that on a factual basis.
And to boil it down into the nutshell that you're talking about, if we want them, somebody's got to pay for them.
Correct. And again, then you get into a set of other issues. So, okay, well, even if we want them and we want to pay for them, does that mean we should raise people's taxes or simply divert existing tax dollars from some other government function? And that's a very, very legitimate conversation to have.
You have been in or around government for 25-plus years. A lot has been made about how the nature of government, or at least the nature of the elected part of government, has changed over the course of that time. Do you think we as the people have changed also? Are there any different expectations of government from the governed today than there were when you were first working on the Hill?
I think certainly I have seen an increase in public cynicism in terms of the public believing that government can actually solve problems and operate effectively and efficiently and get things done. I think that this is actually the decline started in the Vietnam War era, quite frankly. But, you know, the sort of can-do attitude that existed in the 50s and early 60s, and I was born in the early 60s, so I wasn't there for that. But I think that has gone away somewhat, and it's increased over time. And I think that's a problem. I think that because of that cynicism, we have trouble recruiting the best and brightest to want to work in government, to want to run for elected office. And so it feeds upon itself, because then when that happens, then perhaps legitimately government isn't being run very well. That being said, I do think that here in Southeast Wisconsin, local government, for the most part, performs very well. We do a Salute to Local Government event every year recognizing outstanding government performance, and we often have a very difficult time choosing winners. There's lots of examples of very strong and innovative government performance here in our region, and there's lots of examples of city administrators and village administrators in villages and cities across the Southeast Wisconsin region. Nobody knows who they are, but they're very talented people doing a very good job.
You worked in county government before your position at the Public Policy Forum, but before that, you actually came to Milwaukee at the start of the light rail debates and worked for an organization involved in transit funding and transit issues. I'm curious to get your perspective on this longstanding transit debate in this community. What is it about the nature of Milwaukee that makes this debate what it is here today and has apparently always been contentious?
I think that the transit issue has taken on so much symbolism in this town. And I think part of the reason for that is that transit here is not widely used by the general public. It's used here more than in many other urban areas solely by people who don't have any other choice. They don't own or can't operate an automobile. But where the symbolism has come into play is it's really in terms of, I think, the conservative point of view. These big investments in transit infrastructure are emblematic of wasteful government spending, of spending lots of money on something that is not going to be widely used by the general population, but that may only be used by a small segment of the population. And I think to many people that rubs them the wrong way. Now, I can give you plenty of examples of other government expenditures that aren't necessarily being used by everybody, but that are benefiting the general public. Education is a perfect example. There are plenty of people who don't have children or whose children are out of the schools and they're still paying their taxpayer dollars to support them. But here it's sort of been held out as the prime example of government spending my money on something that I don't need and will never use. I think we haven't successfully here pointed out how transit is linked to economic development. We haven't pointed out the workforce development aspect of it as a very critical tool in terms of getting people to jobs. We haven't pointed out the tourism and so on. At the same time, we have very low levels of traffic congestion here. And so there is some legitimacy to the questioning of, do we really need to make investments of this nature?
The Public Policy Forum was ahead of the curve in calling attention to the issue of public employee benefits. Is there another issue like that that you see looming on the horizon?
There is, Mitch. We've talked a little bit about the arts and cultural research we've done, and I think one of the very important yet subtle points that we have made is so we can clearly define for you what the need is in terms of the arts and cultural institutions. What we can't tell you is whether that set of infrastructure needs is more or less important than other infrastructure needs facing this community. In the fiscal analyses that we have done on our major government bodies here, from the city to the county to the sewerage district to the public schools, the capital side of the budget ledger receives very little attention. But in our minds, that is a very pressing problem. We are very concerned at the capacity of this community to be able to address this whole broad spectrum of infrastructure needs, from local roads and streets to county trunk highways to sewage treatment plants and laterals to school buildings and structures to the nature of the state of our performing arts center and our zoo, et cetera. And so the question becomes just how big is that laundry list? When you look at local revenue capacity, do we even have the capacity to address this? So we're going to start to try to quantify that for people, to really take a deep dive into looking at the condition of local infrastructure here and what is it going to take, without the question of whether we need to build anything new like a light rail system or a streetcar, but just in terms of maintaining what we have, do we have the financial capacity to do that? And if not, what are our options?
Was there ever a point at which people, elected officials and the rest of us, were especially good at looking 5, 10, 20 years down the road?
In my estimation, it used to happen a little more, but that's always been a problem. It's always been an issue that for an elected official, whether rightly or wrongly, the time horizon is the next election. And so for the House of Representatives, that's always been 2 years. For the Senate has been more of a deliberative body on the national level because of the six-year terms. But yes, I think that has always been a challenge for government, is that the reward of doing things like long-term planning and making steady investments in infrastructure, so it's not real visible to the public when the potholes are being fixed and the local roads are being repaired, but if you're steadily investing in those and if you're doing upkeep along the way, you don't do a ribbon cutting ceremony when you paint a roof of a park building, but you do when you build something new. And so I think that's why the onus has always been on new and exciting and glamorous, as opposed to general upkeep and maintenance and planning how you're going to do that over long-term periods.
And candidates are always good during election season to talk about crime, but very few of them talk about sewers.
This is correct.
Rob Henkin, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mitch.
Rob Henkin is the president of the nonpartisan Milwaukee-based Public Policy Forum. His conversation was the latest in a series recorded on the sixth floor of the University Club of Milwaukee. We'll take a break now, and in just a moment, why a museum celebrating Wisconsin art is partnering with the government of Luxembourg's Ministry of Culture. This is Lake Effect on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. It's time now for a quick geography quiz. Where is Luxembourg? Okay, we will settle for someplace in Europe. Many of us might have a difficult time precisely placing the small country on a map. It is indeed wedged in between Belgium, Germany, and France. Its population is about 500,000, or less than the city of Milwaukee, and it is 200 square miles smaller than Milwaukee County. But why are we telling you all of this? It's because the country's cultural and business interests reach far around the world, most recently to Wisconsin, where a large population of ethnic Luxembourgers have lived since the mid-19th century. And today, a new partnership between the Museum of Wisconsin Art in West Bend and the Ministry of Culture in Luxembourg will provide a 3-month artist-in-residence program at Borglinster Castle. It's funded by Wisconsin's ANSE Development Corporation, which has significant business ties with Luxembourg. Lori Winters is the CEO of the Museum of Wisconsin Art. Bob Cripps is a senior representative of the ministry. And Mike ANSE is the managing general partner of ANSE Development. They joined Lake Effect's Bonnie North, and Lori Winters explained why the museum pursued this opportunity.
It's part of a strategy that we're developing at MOA to create an environment, something even kind of like a petri dish that will help promote arts and culture in Wisconsin. The hanging works of art on the wall is important, but creating a cultural environment where young artists can flourish is maybe even more important. So that's what we're trying to do, and this fits in perfectly with that strategy.
Well, Mike, for you, why was it so important to support something like this?
Well, it all goes back to our collaboration with the government of Luxembourg, which really started with the Luxembourg American Culture Society, which really started with the way we were raised. Our region, the Port Washington, Belgium, Decatur, Sauk-Bolhe Cross area, was settled by Luxembourgers in the 1840s. And it was reborn. My dad was involved in it, but the government really was the catalyst of our involvement. And this started back in about 2004. And so we developed this partnership. And then as a part of our vision, ANSI Development Corporation, it's a way to give back to our communities. And so we started to recognize how valuable art is, how it's strategic in developing, creating, and innovating. And I saw it as an opportunity to invest on behalf of others. And then we met with Bob and his staff and started to develop this program, of which we fund and invest in on behalf of other people. And so in this particular case, the museum in West Bend was one of those opportunities for us. And it goes back to relationships again. Kevin Steiner, who's active in the organization, and my relationship in the insurance business all kind of was a catalyst. And then ultimately, it's our involvement with Bob and his staff. And we go over every year. We look for ways to promote the government, the culture, and develop it for the future. And it's really about what we're going to do for others. And that's really the plan.
And Bob, a lot of people, if they aren't from this area, might not even really realize or know where Luxembourg is and that culture is so important and that we have these partnerships going on. Why is it important for you and for your government to support something like this?
Well, first, Luxembourg lies in between Germany, France, and Belgium. It is a very small country. It only holds 500,000 inhabitants. And as you might understand, we are very much aware that a third of our population went to the States onward from the 1840s. So that means that we have, for our size, a quite big population, rather here in America and especially here in Wisconsin. And so when these guys here around Mike and his friends build up this fantastic initiative, the Luxembourg American Cultural Society, we, of course, were very much excited about the idea, and we tried to find the best ways to collaborate.
This is the first time that a Wisconsin artist is going to have this opportunity to – I was looking at the brochure and thinking, oh, my goodness, I want to go to the castle, and I want to be there to do that. But somebody will get to do that. How are you making that decision? I imagine that quite a few people are applying.
Quite a few people are applying already, so it will be competitive. We're looking, as we stated in the application, for emerging artists with a successful track record, and that can mean a wide variety of things, and mid-career artists. This is an incredible opportunity for an artist who is just beginning to develop a national or international reputation to travel, to experiment, to see different ways of doing things, to make connections with galleries in Europe, and to sort of help take them to the next level.
Is there a limitation on media, or is it open to anyone doing anything?
It's open. Okay. Definitely, it's open. And, you know, so that's a conversation about how we make that work once we've chosen the candidate. We really want somebody who has a kind of pioneering mindset. And this is the first year of the program. So a lot of how the program works, I think, will be determined by this first individual, you know, whether they want to go and spend their time just working or whether they want to make connections with galleries or whether they want to teach a class at the university. That's all open. That's all a possibility. So we're looking for candidates to come back to us with some suggestions on how they might interact in this international environment of artists.
So you're actually encouraging the artists not only to make art but to help create the program.
Yeah, I actually think that's a good description. I think there will be lots of opportunities. The program may be different from year to year, but the first year is critical in that it opens the door of possibilities.
What happens afterward? Will there be an exhibition of work in Luxembourg and also back here?
still to be determined, and that will emerge with the conversation with the individual artist. So we're going to look at the pool of applicants, narrow it down to three for an in-person interview. And from that point, it really becomes about the conversation and how that individual artist sees themselves working in Luxembourg and what their plans are, what they would like to accomplish during that period.
I would like to say that we fully embrace the strategy that was just described by Laurie. And it is, of course, obvious that the first year will be a year where we'll see. It is a work in progress. We will, of course, see forward to give this artist a possibility for an exhibition.
And I'm assuming that there's not a requirement for the person to be of Luxembourgian descent here, but wouldn't that be interesting if you had an artist that had that to kind of tie it together?
It would be interesting, but it's not a requirement.
Right.
No.
You're surprised by people who don't even know they're Luxembourgian. So you might be surprised even in the application process after you're selected how there might be a connect. Because that's the funny thing. As small as a country as it is, it's connected in so many ways. And that's the power of the country, is that they're able to be agile. They're able to facilitate. And the other thing I find interesting, and, you know, the initiative is something that our corporation is driving on behalf of everybody, and the initiative occurred because of the partnership. But when the design of the initiative and the program, it is an open architectural strategy towards creation. It isn't designed to be something that's confined. And if you understand the government and their strategies, and what Bob does is they're very open to creativity and the evolution of it. So the guidelines of it, when we sat down and established that and we shared that, aren't restrictive. And so the things that Bob's talking about or Laurie's talking about, the innovation of this product will continue. And that's the beauty of the government. They're uniquely different. They don't try to control things. They try to make the environment for the artist such that it can be creative.
Laurie, who's on the committee besides yourself?
There is an internal staff that'll make the first selection to three. And then following that will be an anonymous committee.
Okay. Yeah. But you have, groups of people that are going to be looking at this very, very carefully.
It'll be a group of five.
Okay.
Yeah.
I can't imagine having to pick something like this. I mean, that to me, I think, would be the hardest part of this, because I'm sure the number of candidates that are worthy of this far exceed the positions that you're able to fill. You know, I mean, you're going to have so many.
It's going to be tough.
Yeah. So encourage people to apply the next time around.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So there's no limitation on that. If they don't make it the first time around, they can reapply.
They should definitely reapply.
What do you hope happens, Bob, once this first artist has his or her residency and returns back to the United States? What do you hope that they bring back from this?
Well, there's different levels. So the first one would be that they bring home an impression that is positive on our country and that they fully appreciate the castle and the surroundings of it, and that the place that we installed, I mean, these facilities, that they will really positively play out. And on the second level, and this is maybe the most important, is that we expect this bringing something to the career of the Wisconsin artist in Europe. So we have to work on that and see how we can get him networked and connected to the European art world.
Are you hoping, or are you planning to work with other ministries of culture in other countries in Europe to help, you know, maybe make connections that way too?
Well, we certainly trying to work with other countries, but not, between ministries it's more a general affair and agreements, but this is a concrete project, and these kind of projects we want to develop, of course.
Yeah, the other beauty of it too, the collaboration, they're going to be immersed with other artists from all over Europe in different regions. So that artist from Wisconsin is going to be networked in a sense already by being and creating art with multiple artists from within Europe. So it's a networking session for them personally too, that they have the opportunity besides the government on their behalf. Because the way the government works and the way your team works, Bob, they're very passionate about this and they're going to help avail people more. But it's the initiative of the artist. I mean, at the end of the day, in your selection process and who you select, that person has to have the ambition. And you know, art is an interesting thing. First, you're very creative and innovative, but then you almost have to be entrepreneurial, right?
I mean, oh, you must be.
Yeah,
I think so.
And so for an entrepreneurial person, you're being incubated in a world that here you have a ministry that wants to promote this, which, as we all know, in government today, that's always a challenged opportunity. But beyond that, they're put in a pool of other people. And so it's a thing that's so unique about Luxembourg. They're so small but yet so well-positioned all over Europe. I mean, right now the former prime minister of the government is now the president of the EU nations. And it kind of tells you that Luxembourgers are networkers. That's really their history and heritage.
So, Mike, what are you hoping that this first artist brings back to Wisconsin?
Well, I think, you know, I actually wear a lot of different hats. I'm a consul general for the government, and so I also have a responsibility in promoting it. So one of the things in cooperation with Bob saying is the experience when you go to Luxembourg is a unique experience. And for that person, they then become an advocate for the government, for the people, and for the experience because it is strategically located in Europe. It has more French cuisine restaurants per capita than any place in the world, 5-star. And so it's a special place. And so if they come back, get that experience, are positive about the experience, they're going to be the best ambassador known to any of us. And that's kind of how Luxembourg works. It's word of mouth. That's how this program got. That's how they invested 400,000 euro in the Immigration Museum in Belgium, Wisconsin, how they built a pilot house in Port Washington. That's Luxembourg.
Well, bringing it back to the art, Laurie, what do you hope that this does, not only for the artist, but for the Museum of Wisconsin Art?
Well, I just love this philosophy,
yes.
You know, because it fits so perfectly with what, you know, our philosophy as a new institution is, and that is to just do it. I mean, there are so many great ideas out there. And, you know, to make them happen and be supportive of Wisconsin artists, to maintain high standards, to give Wisconsin artists the opportunity to have an international experience and bring that experience back here is an amazing thing. We have terrific artists working in this state, many of whom have national and international reputations already. So this is giving them a further opportunity and also celebrating the greatness of Wisconsin art.
I was thinking in terms of a small and nimble. It kind of describes the museum as well.
Absolutely.
And being able to move and being able to, you know, react quickly to something like this that comes along.
Absolutely.
Well, this is a fantastic program. I look forward to talking to whoever you choose whenever that person is announced and maybe when they come back and they can tell us about their experience in Luxembourg because I certainly want to hear it.
Great.
Thank you all for coming in this morning. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Bob Cripps is a senior representative of the Luxembourg Ministry of Culture. Laurie Winters is director and CEO of the Museum of Wisconsin Art in West Bend. And Mike Ansay is managing general partner of Ansay Development Corporation. The deadline to apply for the Artist in Residence program in Luxembourg is September 8th. The winner will be announced at the museum on the 20th. One last break, and then another sort of break. Surfers looking for breaking waves at a Milwaukee area park this weekend. We will learn more after the break on Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM. Of Lake Effect Now, I'm Mitch Teich. Late Saturday afternoon, surfers will descend on Atwater Beach on Lake Michigan's shore in Milwaukee County. But this will be more than rugged types braving the elements in search of a good wave. It is a celebration organized by the Wisconsin chapter of a national group called Surf Rider Foundation. Now in its second year, Surf at Water features everything from a film festival to surfing lessons. WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz paddled down to the beach, surfboard in hand, to meet with a couple of the event organizers. They explain why they think surfing can help connect people to the important mission to protect the Great Lakes. But first, they introduce themselves.
I'm Eric Gitson. I'm a teacher. I'm a Shorewood native. I'm the chairman of Wisconsin Surfrider Foundation.
My name is Kenneth Cole, Shorewood resident and psychologist and also surfer and vice chairman as well.
So let's dip back. How did you come to the world of surfing?
I did my internship on Wahoo back in 94, and that was from Chicago, and fell in love with it right away. And it's the type of thing that once you start, it's hard to stop. So when I moved back to the Midwest, I did an internet search and found out that folks were surfing in the Great Lakes and just dove headfirst back into it.
I guess my first encounter with a wave on Lake Michigan was when I was two, and a wave knocked me down and pulled me out. I almost died. Ever since, I've been, you know, negotiating with waves on Lake Michigan. In 1986, a very good friend of mine came home with a surfboard he found in Madison in a junk pile, and we took it out. That's when we got hooked. And like Ken said, once you start surfing, it's hard to stop.
So when you surf here, what are the right conditions and how far out do you go to catch it and really ride it in?
We're all watching wind. We have our eyes on what the wind is going to do, you know, a week or 2 weeks out. And we know that when there's a strong enough wind from the north or the south, depending on what direction and velocity of the wind, we kind of know what the equation is and where the waves are going to be breaking.
So as we're looking out here, where might you be?
We usually go no further out than a little bit past the end of the piers. Oh, a fish just jumped out there. A little bit past the end of the piers.
Is that for real? Or you're just saying that
fish really did just jump. That fish jumped. It's pretty cool. The other night I went a little bit farther out. Depending how big the waves are, you can go farther out. If the wind is really cranking, you can get out. There's some big waves way outside. On a smaller day, we'll be in the middle here, and they'll be breaking in the middle.
And that's one of the things, too, that is unique. Back in Hawaii, where I learned, the vibe is amazing. You can find your pockets of guys and have some great friends there. But when I came back here, it kind of reminds me of really the islands. The vibe, the stoke is extremely high. And I remember when I saw Eric again for the first time, I saw this guy on a board just said, "Hey." And I didn't know who he was. Because, you know, we're both a little bit older now. But the fact that 12 years can go by and then you can come right back and pick up just where you left off really says a lot about the people we have here in the Great Lakes.
Ken's exactly right. A lot of coastal surfers will compare what we have here to what they had back in the 50s, the 40s and the 50s, sort of the golden age of surfing when there wasn't a lot of aggression in the water, which you'll find on the coasts these days. There wasn't a lot of commercialism in the water, which you'll definitely find on the coast these days. What you have here is still, to this day, I mean, 1986, there were probably 10 of us, you know, in the metro Milwaukee area who were surfing. Now there are, I don't know, hundreds who surf, but we still have this great feeling, this vibe among us that, you know, we do something kind of crazy and kind of unique, and it's nothing like the ocean. I mean, let's get that straight. Ocean waves are better. But what we have here...
I thought you'd say different.
No, they're definitely better. They're definitely better. But what we have here that's the same is we pursue waves here. We look for good surf. We talk about waves when we're in the water. We love it. You know, a February day, it's 20 degrees out, and, you know, I'm out with three of my friends and maybe my sons, and we're surfing. The sun comes out. It's like it's paradise. So that feeling is something special to the Great Lakes that I think the coasts have lost.
So stoke, are you talking about being stoked?
How would you define stoke? Just feeling good. Simply feeling happy. And, I mean, just even now, if you listen, I have to assume that you'd rather be here in silence than at home in front of the TV. So even this is a level of stoke that you can't capture anywhere else.
When I first talked to you, I thought, well, wouldn't this be at Bradford Beach? I mean, doesn't everything happen at Bradford Beach? But part of what you said, Eric, is that you're mindful of the mission.
Right, yeah. And the mission is to, as Ken just said, make people aware of this amazing resource that we have. And not necessarily a lot of other stuff. We want to get them in the water. We want to get them ultimately to love the water. And then we want to share some films that surfers have made to help, you know, the audience make a connection between where they live what we do and the potential of this resource, whether it's paddling, surfing, swimming, it doesn't matter. We want to get people in the lake so they love it. So the scale of the event, obviously we have boundaries, geographic boundaries on the beach right here. But also, you know, one of the boundaries we've drawn is we want the event to be appropriately scaled for a fun event, but not something of the scale of Bradford Beach.
So there's been a lot of attention in this spot. The bluff was completely rebuilt and shored up. Over the last 3 years, I think there's been a concerted effort to inform people who live right here what the importance of our Great Lake and the Great Lakes, our waters are. Ken tells me that's part of your scene.
It is. It is part of my scene. In my other life, I'm an English teacher at Shorewood High School, and I am part of an amazing program called Watershed Wisdom, where we teach our students about the value of the Milwaukee River watershed and some of the challenges of the Milwaukee River watershed. So the health of our rivers directly connects to this pursuit that Ken and I are involved in of surfing. And making that connection for my students, bringing them down here, putting them in the Milwaukee River, talking to them about surfing, which is, you know, kind of a fun, cool activity, helps them understand that if you can love it, you can save it. And we're at a point now in the Great Lakes. We need more and more people to be aware of the fact that that our waters need to be protected and saved. But we're not going to do that unless we really love it. And what Ken and I do, what some of my students are now doing, I'll see students in the lineup now. It's really cool. I'll see like 6 or 7 of my students in the water on a good day. We're teaching them to love this lake. And when you love something, you will protect it. But the love's got to come first.
What's your concern about the lakes? Climate change rumbling through your brain?
Not so much climate change, but non-point source pollutants are, I guess, the biggest issue.
That's all part of what the Shorewood Group is trying to inform people about, right? I mean, right. What we do in our homes and exactly. What happens on our streets and our green spaces is impacting the lake.
Well, what just happened to Lake Erie, it may or may not happen here, but what we have in common is phosphorus. That's what caused the problem in Lake Erie. Plenty of phosphorus being dumped on our shorelines and our watersheds. So that's just one example of...
So phosphorus in the form of fertilizer, usually.
Exactly, yeah, which contributes to the cladophora growth. And when cladophora starts washing up on our shorelines and people look at it and smell it and see it, they say, that's disgusting, I'm going to the pool. We need to reverse that dynamic and get people to understand that, you know, the cycle that creates that eyesore and that smell is something that's going to keep them away from this. And if we start ignoring it, we're going to lose it.
What do you think can be achieved through your efforts?
Get out on a board, experience the lake, as Ken said earlier, from a different perspective, and you'll embrace it in ways you never thought were possible.
Which is partly why I think our films are different this year, too. Last year, we had a great selection of films, and our buddy Ryan pulled that together. This year, he has pulled together a different batch of films that we think will welcome more folks to the lake. One is about an African-American surfer from the 1950s that very few know about. And another one is about women over 50, I think, who surf. And they're both really, really moving. And then, of course, we have one about Great Lake surfers. It lets people know that surfing goes beyond the surfer dude mentality, or image, rather, and is really open to all folks, which is something I, for one, would like to gradually see more of here. Because I think it's important for people to come down and feel like they are welcome here.
Ken just mentioned Ryan Bigelow. He's been a part of the surf scene here forever. He is our film guru and part of the original group of the Great Lakes Surf Collective.
How did you decide on last year's event? What brought that together?
You know, we
it was organic.
It was really organic.
I think it goes back to Glenn Henning, who started Surfrider 30 years ago. He is a friend of ours, and I spoke with him a while ago. And he had said, much like you had said, Eric, if you want to protect something, you can't just do a beach cleanup. It has to go much, much, much beyond that. Because basically, I mean, honestly, who wants to pick up trash in the first place? So he was saying, you have to do something that makes the beach exciting and fun. And then we just brainstormed over coffee, and it just came together.
You know, Ryan was throwing out some great ideas about films. Eventually, it became a film fest. And it really still is. It's just that this year we're making it a little more interesting. We've got a Hawaiian band coming. We've got prone surfing and stand-up surfing lessons.
Ukulele.
We got ukulele, yeah. So trying to get that aloha vibe right here in Shorewood.
And you both play, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I do.
And one thing we have to mention, too, which must be told, this event brings surfing back to its roots. Tom Blake was born here in 1902, and he is, in essence, the reason why we're here. He's a Wisconsin native who, kind of on his own, has helped invent the fin, the hollow surfboard, and has brought surfing to where it's at today. And that's something most folks have no idea about.
That was Kenneth Cole and Eric Gitson, the Shorewood residents are chair and co-chair of Surfrider Foundation Wisconsin. There is more about Saturday's second annual Surf at Water event at wuwm.com/lake effect. Finally today, we remember James Foley. The journalist and Marquette University alum was reported to be executed yesterday by the militant group ISIS about a year and a half after being kidnapped while covering the turmoil in Syria. It was the second time Foley had been abducted while reporting from a war zone. He was held captive for nearly 7 weeks in Libya in 2011. Foley talked about that experience with Lake Effect Bonnie North on a show in 2012, soon after speaking at his alma mater. He talked about whether he planned for the possibility of capture when reporting from a war zone.
No, there was no plan, because that would be, you know, if something goes south, you're either wounded, dead, or captured. And, you know, fortunately, we were captured rather than wounded or killed right away. But the plan was usually stick to the rebel vehicle you're with. Hopefully they're, you know, you can trust them more than the average. And when they retreat, you're in the back. The problem was that morning we weren't close enough to the vehicle. And the gunfire was directly targeted at us. So
who did they think you were?
You know, who knows? I've thought about it over and over again. Rebels don't wear uniforms. And, you know, they saw these people crushed to the ground, which we were. They very well might not have seen their camera, but I will say that no shots were fired at them. So clearly they were firing on somebody who was unarmed.
Obviously, you know, being captured is a fear that all journalists have. When you were captured, were you afraid that you were going to die?
To tell you the truth, it's an abstract question. Because it happened so quickly, in a matter of minutes, I believe, we were under serious fire, most serious fire of my life, and Anton was killed. And everything was pure instinct at that point. The only time I had to think, I had to decide to stand up and surrender. Now, that was probably the most dangerous time because I could have been cut down there. They were very close out of their vehicles firing. And they immediately subdued us by hitting us with rifle butts and punches and tied us up. So did I think I was going to be executed? No. But I was very familiar with the New York Times story. They had been captured almost a month before, and I was very familiar. There were, you know, sustained beatings and threats. So I was expecting that.
And these were Gaddafi's forces that captured you?
Exactly. These were Gaddafi. These were young Gaddafi soldiers.
How were you treated in those 44 days?
It was progressively better. The first day was awful, both because we witnessed our colleague killed, because we were beaten, and there was so much uncertainty. But quickly, within a few hours, after we were taken to a sort of safe house in the town of Brega, we were captured, somewhat senior soldiers showed up and sort of said, okay, everything's okay, and, you know, looked at our IDs and said, we're taking you to CERT, Gaddafi's hometown. A few days later, we were moved to Tripoli, and, you know, we were in a prison system. We were in a prison system, but the prison system had been revamped to hold revolutionaries, and the court system had been revamped to hold revolutionaries, and they were processing hundreds and thousands of people, literally. And by the time we were in the last few weeks of our imprisonment, I was in a prison cell with, you know, about eight other revolutionaries from around Tripoli in those cities in the West, and I saw that these people were never going to give up, and it was not a civil war. It was a true revolution in the sense that both sides of the country were united against Gaddafi.
Are you going to continue to do this work? Are the risks worth it even after what you went through?
Yes. I definitely learned, you know, that awful things can happen if you don't take precautions, and that risk-taking for the sake of risk-taking is foolish, and, you know, you're playing with your life and life of others. But I'm still excited to go into conflict zones and try to cover them. And I think it's a close brotherhood and sisterhood of people that will support you. And it's fascinating until I really know in my gut that I don't want to do it anymore.
Freelance journalist and Marquette alum Jim Foley speaking in 2012 on Lake Effect about his 2011 ordeal when he was captured in Libya. Foley, who was a Marquette University graduate, was executed by Islamist militants in Syria yesterday, a year and a half after being abducted there. He was 40 years old. That's all for Wednesday's edition of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock, and Fresh Air is next.